Hello, and welcome to the Weekly News Roundup, a podcast of the Daily News. My name is Ann Brennan, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Metro West Daily News and the Milford Daily News. On Fridays, we discuss local stories that made the headlines with the reporters who covered them. This week, we'll talk about how dental therapists could reduce a backlog in dental care for low-income patients. Sierra Naturals in Milford seeks to amend its greenhouse permit, and a Natick police officer makes a special delivery. This week, the Framingham City Council, after a somewhat contentious debate over some new positions that the mayor was trying to create, passed a budget for $284.7 million. And to talk about that with us is Jim Hattadine. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So what can you tell us about this whole thing of the positions and what's cuts, what was cut, what was saved in this budget?
Yeah, so it's interesting that, you know, there was maybe a month of discussions around the first city budget, and, you know, the Finance Committee really went into detail with all kinds of city departments, made a variety of requests to, you know, lower certain funding amounts in the budget proposed by the mayor, and really the maybe 90% of the conversation at the city council level was focused solely on the mayor's office. This was really kind of the issue that people wanted to flesh out was, what is the appropriate staffing for the mayor? And at a meeting on Tuesday, the city council passed the operating budget for the city. It's the first city operating budget since Framingham made this transition. And they did support recommendations from the finance committee to cut a variety of positions that the mayor wanted to have in her office, including a communications director for the city, one of the two senior advisors that the mayor has already brought on to work in her office since January, and a diversity director position, which is really where much of the conversation was focused. I think if the council was going to be swayed to add more money in for these positions, that's where it would have been, and in the end, they didn't go for it.
It seemed like they might have left the door open a little, though, asking her to justify the position if she was really intent on adding it in the next budget cycle.
Yeah, the council was really adamant that they do recognize the need to do something about diversity in Framingham. You have city government and, you know, elected officials that really don't reflect what the community looks like right now. And that's, you know, part of the charter reform was establishing a job of a citizen participation officer. And some of the that person's duties is going to be looking at diversity and trying to get more people involved in government. So I think the council looked at that request from the mayor, and you know, some of the sentiment is that this citizens participation officer can do some of the job of promoting diversity in the city. That's one reason that they didn't support funding a separate position at this time. And there were also some concerns about the way this job had been kind of outlined in the mayor's budget message. Some councilors said during the discussion Tuesday that they didn't think this was a job description that was really tailored to what Framingham needs, or really written with kind of specific knowledge of where Framingham is lacking in diversity or training for its staff and things like that. So after a variety of proposals, the council supported a resolution from Cheryl Tully Stoll, the at-large counselor for the city, one of two, to conduct a study using money from the Human Resources Department budget into, you know, exactly what the diversity needs are in Framingham, and to kind of craft a specific job description for a diversity officer who perhaps will be added to the city staff in the future.
And so you're saying that this would be somebody who would kind of monitor and promote a more diverse workforce in the government workforce. That's how it was presented to us that at this point.
Yeah, part of the aims would be trying to figure out how to bring more people of color, people from different backgrounds, into city government to actually work for the city. Part of it would be doing, you know, sensitivity training for the staff that's there, developing some kind of ongoing training, monitoring issues that do arise, and, you know, kind of whatever else this study would point at and say this is something that this job needs to do.
And maybe some outreach to communities that are more minority communities as well.
Sure. And there are, you know, there are models of this in other places that Framingham could look to. There's a cabinet level position in Boston and in Marty Walsh's administration for a diversity officer. Springfield is looking at adding this in. There's been some pushback there. Worcester has had this position for about 2 years now, and some smaller communities also have dedicated diversity officers. So it's not unprecedented to do this, and it looks like it's kind of a growing trend in different municipalities in the state.
So the other part of the budget is that good news, I guess, for the taxpayers is there's no tax increase this year.
Yeah, you'll still be paying taxes. And the funny kind of math here is you might actually see an increase in your taxes, but that's not necessarily from the budget that the city has just passed. This is revaluation time, so people are seeing their property values rise. So as a result of that, many property owners are probably going to see an increase in what they're paying in taxes. But the tax levy increase is 0% for this year due to some strategic moves that came out of the Finance Committee and were supported by the council. The largest chunk of that is taking a little more than $2 million that the mayor and the finance chief for the city had proposed putting into a capital stabilization fund, which is this fund for kind of big projects that are looming in the future, chiefly the Fuller Middle School project, which is going to cost more than $100 million, of which Framingham is on the hook for about half of that. So that money had been pegged to go into this kind of long-term savings with the idea that they're going to need to spend it in a few years. In the end, they reduced that to not put the money into the capital stabilization fund. They looked at it and said, the impact on the tax bill is going to be saving maybe $5 trying to think of how the math works out here.
Right.
The impact on the tax bill for somebody, if you see that money paid off in a long-term debt project, is not as significant as giving people the tax break right now in the taxes they're going to pay. So if you cancel out that levy increase, people will see a better short-term benefit from that, and they might be more supportive of the Fuller Middle School project in the future.
Okay. Well, another story that you had on the subject of diversity, Framingham State is going to rename a dorm for the first African-American graduate from the school.
This idea came from a student at Framingham State, Carl Bryant. He is was the student trustee on the board and was a senior. I believe Mr. Bryant has graduated. I wasn't able to connect with him directly to talk about this idea, but I guess at some point in the last several months, he came to Javier Ceballos, the president of FSU, and said, we've got North Hall on campus. It's just named after where it is on campus to the north. So he proposed instead renaming it for the first African-American graduate of the school, Mary Miles Bibb, who lived in the mid-19th century. She was an abolitionist and was prominent in kind of spreading the abolitionist message. Her home in, she relocated to Canada with her husband. Her home became a stop on the Underground Railroad for escaped slaves who were heading north. And she was also a journalist, perhaps one of the first Canadian journalists and a female Canadian journalist, and put out with her husband this newspaper, I think it was called Voice of the Fugitive, which, touched on these same issues. So she was really an interesting figure, someone who's been celebrated already in Canada and in the United States for her contributions to the anti-slavery movement. And Framingham State has kind of come to recognize her importance and her history in the last few years with a few different things. They've got a teaching fellowship in her name and hosted a presentation within the last several years on kind of her historical significance. So Mr. Bryant's idea was to rename the dorm in her honor, and it seemed like an idea that everybody really got behind. So he collected more than 100 signatures from students saying that they supported this idea, brought it to the Board of Trustees, and in at their meeting in May, they supported this idea. So it still has to go up to the state Board of Higher Education, or perhaps the Commissioner of Higher Education can also take action on it too during the summer when there's kind of a lull in how regularly they meet. So they could approve that in June. It could be a little while, but it seems like this is it's going to happen later this year.
And she graduated in something like 1848 or 1846, something around there. And
I think it might have been 1843.
Oh, okay. And she was also a teacher. I think you may... I can't remember if you mentioned that in before, but she was a teacher that had her own school for something like 20 years.
Yes, I neglected to mention. So Framingham State was then the Lexington Normal School. It was the precursor to FSU, which was a teaching school for women, part of the normal school system in the United States. So she is had this career for 23 years as a teacher as well.
Well, thank you, Jim, for taking the time to come in and talk to us. I know how busy you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Busy times in Framingham.
Yes. The state legislature is looking at a plan to create what are called dental therapists. They would be a level of care provider between a dentist and a dental hygienist. And joining us to talk about that is Henry Schwann. Hello, Henry.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good.
Good.
So tell us more about this dental therapist plan.
So you described it pretty well, I think. It's a mid-level position. It would, as you said, fall in between a hygienist and a dentist. And the dental therapist, the point of creating this position, at least the proponents at the State House who are trying to make this happen, feel that this position would help reach underserved and uninsured residents in Massachusetts. It would provide greater access to dental care for communities that really need it.
And what type of dental care are we talking about? Are they, I know dental hygienists usually do teeth cleanings and things like that. Would a dental therapist be able to maybe fill a cavity or what's their vision?
Yeah, well, there are basic dental work care. Well, more than a hygienist, but certainly not at a level of a trained and licensed dentist. And there are requirements of a dental therapist in the bill. For example, 2,500 hours of supervised training underneath a dentist, or 2 years, whichever is greater. And then there are other requirements, a master's degree from an accredited dental program, and then the passage of an exam an exam that has been vetted by dental authorities nationally and statewide. So there would be training. And to make a long story short, the care that a dental therapist would provide would be, some of it would be supervised, some of it could be off-site, but more comprehensive and complicated care would probably be performed by a dentist.
But if somebody, say, needed a tooth pulled or you know, a minor cavity, that's what they're trying to address in these areas that are underserved?
Yeah. I mean, there are, for example, we spoke to the head of the dental department at the Edward M. Kennedy Community Health Center, which has dental locations in Framingham, Worcester, and Clinton. And they last year had 26,000 patients. And the Dr. Brian Jenna, who is the director of that program, said that this would be a great thing for that sort of population. 90%, Dr. Jenna said 90% of those patients are on MassHealth, which is the state insurance program for low income and the elderly and the disabled. And so he feels that it would be it's a great idea for that population. However, he had one caveat, and that is that he's a little concerned about the education component. He just wants to make sure that dental therapists are completely supervised initially, and then after maybe, he didn't really specify how many months or years, but he feels once a dentist is comfortable with the level of care and training that a therapist would have, then they could go off-site and potentially provide unsupervised care.
Kind of like a nurse practitioner, maybe.
Yeah, right. Yeah, kind of like that, yeah.
But there is also a caveat that while they hope to, that this new dental therapist position would be able to address the need. Mm-hmm. Some are saying it may not address the total need.
Yeah, that's true, Ann. Dr. David Lusbader, he is the president of the Massachusetts Dental Society. And when we spoke to him, the Daily News spoke to him, he indicated that he's on board with the bill, but there's an underlying problem, which you just mentioned, and that is MassHealth reimbursements. According to Dr. Lusbader, they fall between 30 and 40% of the expenses associated with care, with procedures given. And a lot of private dentists just won't take MassHealth because they need, according to Dr. Lusbader, a minimum of 65% reimbursement just to cover their cost. So until Dr. Lusbader feels until that issue is addressed at the state level and the federal level, there's still going to be a gap in care for those underserved and uninsured communities. He also mentioned that in Minnesota, they've had dental therapists for close to a decade. And the intention was for them to go out into rural communities where there is a very short supply of dentists. According to Dr. Lusbader, it hasn't actually worked out that way. He said a fair number of dental therapists are securing employment in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, a metropolitan area, because that's where the money is, that's where the jobs are, and dental therapists need to pay their bills, so that's where they go to get their jobs. He's hoping the same pattern is not repeated here.
So when do you think the legislature may act on this?
Well, Kate Hogan, who is the co-chair of the committee that is pushing this bill, push this bill forward to the full House and Senate, and she's hoping that it will be voted on by the House and Senate before the end of July. But then it has to go to the governor's desk, and he has to sign it. So there are a lot of unknowns, but she's hopeful that the bill will be passed by the end of this July,
which is the end of the legislative session, and
right.
We have to start all over again, or at least be picked up next year.
Right, Ann.
Well, Henry, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
On Saturday evening, a fire broke out in the former R&T Furniture building in Northboro, and our reporter John Phelps was there. John joins us now to tell us about this huge fire.
Hello.
Hello, John.
So I was working Saturday. There was a graduation in the morning, and I was doing some things around the newsroom, and we got a phone call that a big fire was happening in Northboro. It turns out it was a former R&T Furniture building, which had been vacant for many, many years.
Looked like it was about 13 years. The company closed in 2005.
Yeah, I think, I don't know for sure, but I think they kind of opened up, like they kind of semi-kept the business going, so there was kind of customers in and out when they could be there. So it's kind of tricky to tell the history, but it was a vacant building. Very old building. The original part of the building was built in 1900s, early 1900s, so it was quite the blaze.
And it was a four-alarm fire, so they had a lot of people show up. It was a kind of a warm evening, and the fire chief was saying it took a miracle to prevent this fire from spreading to other nearby buildings.
Yeah, so the building's kind of wedged in between a gas station and then a car service station. So two businesses you probably wouldn't want to light up. So the firefighters did a really good job of, they call it like a defensive attack. So they were good at getting water onto the service garage. It was literally feet away just because of the layout of the land.
And the roads were closed around there. It was such a...
Like, yeah.
How big is the building, or how big was the building?
R&T Furniture? I'm not exactly sure, but I will say this. I grew up in Northboro. I live in Northboro now, and I cannot recall a time except for when there was a parade when all of downtown was shut down. So I do have some stats here about the fire that I was able to get. So they brought in 12 engine companies, 3 ambulance units, 4 ladder trucks, and had a command support staff of 4. So overall, they had like 84 firefighters working.
Wow. And how long did it take them to get the fire out?
It took about 3 hours to say that it was under control. And my understanding what happened is they stayed until like 1 in the morning. It started around 4:30 in the afternoon. So they were there for a long time. But once they were able to get information that they needed, they used drones and stuff to kind of document the fire. The owner brought in an excavator and tore the building down.
Yeah, on that was early. That was Monday, right? That they went in.
No, actually, they came back on Monday to finish up the job, but they were there that night
to destroy the
building. It was the only way the fire chief thought they could really say that the fire was out for sure.
Especially when you're in between a gas station and a car care company that might have a lot of solvents and other materials that are highly flammable. So this building had been of interest to the selectmen as well and other town officials because it was kind of a blighted building at this point.
Yeah, so I wrote a story a couple months ago about just vacancies in downtown Northborough, and selectmen have kind of had their eye on this. Actually, going back to 2013, just nothing's happened at the building, and they kind of saw it deteriorating. They're wondering what the owners are doing. The owner had hired a structural engineer to write up a report, but he didn't do any of the work. I was told that he didn't do any of the work that was listed in the report, so the town kind of had their eye on it. The town building inspector said there's nothing they could really do because the owner was paying taxes.
Mm-hmm. Any idea what caused the fire?
It's undetermined at this time. It could be a number of things. I mean, it's an old vacant building. It had electricity going to it. That's what the chief said. The chief said he would be a little more concerned if there was no electricity in terms of what the cause would be.
Okay, well, John, thank you very much. You can see photos from the scene and video that John shot while he was there. Those links will be with the show notes of this episode.
All right, thanks for having me.
Well, on Tuesday night, just as Natick police officers Ryan Colleen and Jim Cohane were about to call it a day, they were called to make a special delivery. Joining us now is Norm Miller, who covers crime and beer. What can you tell us about this story?
Well, I was speaking to Officer Colleen from Natick the other day, and basically it was a slow night in Natick. It's 11:30. They get off duty at midnight, so they usually get to the station around 11:45 when they get a call for a woman who's getting ready to deliver a baby in the back of the car. They drive. They get to the section where the happening. Father waves them down. They go to the car, and there's no time to waste. The baby was already on its way out. They get some blankets, make the mother comfortable, and a few seconds later, the baby came, bouncing baby girl came out. I talked to Ryan Colleen, like I said, and he was funny. He was saying, like, I had to do everything I could not to pass out. He was overwhelmed. He was like, you're not prepared for something like that. They see two videos during a police academy, and that's the only training he's ever had to do with delivering a baby. He was telling me, it's funny, he was saying after, like, they're waiting for the ambulance to leave, and he realized, I never got their name, because he was just, like, overwhelmed by everything, so...
Well, he was able to find their names and visit them in the hospital, the mom and baby.
Yeah, he was in court yesterday for a hearing, and his shift started at 4, so he rushed to Newton Wellesley because he was hoping to find a family.
Oh, that's the hospital she
went
to.
Yeah, Newton Wellesley Hospital. He went there, he was able to find a family, actually get to know him, and held the baby. He was very excited about it.
I liked in your story, the beginning of your story, it was that Ryan Colleen could barely breathe.
Yeah,
during this.
Yeah, and that's basically what he said. He's like, he said something, I didn't get it to the story, but he goes, yeah, I was delivering a baby, and off Jimmy Cahane was making sure I wasn't passing out. But it was funny, because he's been in office for 7 years. I asked him if he's ready to do it again, and he's like, yeah, but I need another 7 years before I do it again.
And this is the second one for our area. There was one earlier this year in Framingham.
Yeah, it's a similar situation. This one... They were driving from the one in Natick was driving from Ashland to Newton Wellesley. The other one never made it out of their house. They went in the house, and the officer, the woman's in the bathroom, and the whole head's out at that. The baby's already crying at that point. But yeah, so this is the second one locally in this calendar year.
Well, on what's new on the beer front?
Well, this week I featured a brand new brewery from Holden, Seven Saws Brewing Company. They just opened their tap room last week. And they sold out a beer before the day was even over on Saturday. Real small brewery, four friends. You know, they came up, they all home brewers, you know, and like a lot of great ideas. They came up with the idea to open a brewery while they're drinking beer around a fire pit. And unlike a lot of people, those great ideas actually stuck with them. They didn't think better of it after. So they just opened up. I went there last weekend just to give it a shot. I tried samples of most of the beers. For a first weekend beer, they're pretty darn good. Today, I'm working on a story. A new brewery is going to be opening in Marlboro within the next month or so. Strange Brew has been a long time homebrew shop in Marlboro. They've been open for 21 years in four or five different locations in the city. They're in the former Laser Zone building now, and it's a very large building. It's about 16,000 square feet. So they're actually splitting the building basically in half. So half of it's going to remain a homebrew shop. Other half is going to be a small little brewery with a tap room, and they're going to have an outdoor beer garden for seating for about a... They're going to start small, but eventually about 100 people outdoors. They're going to have different rooms inside. They're going to have the main little tap room. They're going to have another area, which he calls the Strange Room, which will have like all like tie-dye stuff and video games, and another room with tabletop seating so that people can bring in food. He knows how to brew. I've known the owner, Brian Powers, for years. He's been wanting to open a brewery for years, and now that he has the space, and Marlboro's, you know, been wanting to bring a brewery to town for about a year now. So he's taking advantage of opening his brewery. He has an interesting concept. He's going to be basically brewing a version of a beer, but he's going to split the batches. One's going to be the regular version of a beer. The second one's going to be the strange version of the beer. So it might be like the regular version might be like a golden ale, a light, easy drinking beer. And the strange version might be the golden ale, triple hopped with 18 different types of hops, or regular IPA. Then the next one might be an IPA brewed with tons of fresh fruit. So you get to see two different versions. His whole goal is he spent the last 21 years helping and teaching people how to homebrew. So he still wants to educate people about beer, and that's what he's hoping to do. He's going to be running the tap room himself. He still wants to teach people about beer just from a different angle now.
Well, that all sounds really good. I just want to add that John Hickenlooper, the governor of Colorado, started out as a home brewery.
Yes, he did. A couple of years ago, he gave, I think he's done it more than once, the keynote address at the Big Brewers Association's event they have out there every year. He started as a home brewer. If I remember, I'm drawing a blank on the name of the, I think he ended up owning a brewery or a brew pub for a while as well, but... Yeah, he's in Colorado. Is definitely one of the forefathers of accepting beer. They're way ahead of a lot of states. I mean, Massachusetts was way behind, and now it's starting to catch up. But Colorado was one of the first states that really, really took to craft beer and opening breweries and tap rooms and everything like that.
So we'll see how the four friends do as they progress. And maybe there's politics in the future. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, one's a dentist. So I suggested maybe having a free cleaning with every beer, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, thanks, Norm, for joining us. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
In Sudbury this week, Mrs. A.B., a teacher who's been teaching in the Sudbury Elementary Schools for 50 years, retired, and there was a party held for her. Zane Razak is with us to tell us about the party and about Mrs. A.B.
Yep. So Florence Aldrich Bennett was a teacher at Peter Noyes Elementary School in Sudbury for 54 years. She's retiring this year, and she's been a third grade teacher. She's worked in Sudbury her entire career. She started at the Horse Pond School when it was still around, and then bounced around between Loring and Nixon, and then she went to Noyes in the 1980s and has been there since, even after those other schools reopened.
Well, one of the things that you wrote about is the number of cards and letters that she sends to former students.
Yeah, she's most known for that. She sends birthday cards almost every day to old students, and she was talking about how she, you know, goes to the post office in Concord where she lives and sends out a couple hundred cards per month. So a lot of the people at the party I was talking with were bringing up the cards and how they had memories of them. One person I spoke with, he was her student 45 years ago, and he remembers getting one even after he had graduated college. And then another little girl I talked with, she is a member of the last class for Mrs. A.B., and she was mentioning how Mrs. A.B. had sent her sister a card, even though she was never her student. So she really goes out of her way to make everyone, you know, feel special.
Right. And the little girl you're talking about was new to the school, and the parents were talking about how nice it was that they got this email from the teacher saying, would she like to come and do a tour in the summer to help her get settled, and how much that helped. I know the person, I think it was the guy who got the, was her pupil 45 years ago, saying she gave her all, like any student that enters her classroom gets everything that she has to give.
Yep. Yeah, and I also spoke with the principal, Annette Doyle, who was talking about how they'd see her car come into the parking lot at like 6 a.m. and sometimes beating the custodians, and she would stay there often until 8 p.m. just kind of going over worksheets and making sure everything was all set for her students.
Right. And the other thing I thought was interesting, too, like she started in something like 1964, and how much has changed in the classroom, especially with technology. But her colleague said she always stayed up with all of the things that were the advances.
Yeah, she's, I guess, really excited about technology and incorporating it into her curriculum. So she uses active boards and other new tools in her classroom.
Well, staying on the theme of education, the Metro West and Milford Daily News covered many, many graduations over the last week, high school graduations. There were some college, but those were a few weeks ago. And Zane, you covered the one in Milford, and there was a special guest at that graduation.
Yeah, one of the students, Justin Pascasio, he graduated this year, and as he got up to cross the stage and get the diploma, the principal kind of said, you know, we want to welcome a special guest. And then his brother, who was in the Marines, came up on the stage with him and kind of surprised him and gave him the diploma. And everyone, you know, applauded. It was really cute.
Right. And did he expect his brother to be there? Was his brother normally stationed somewhere far away, or...
It was a surprise for the whole family. He was the Marine. He was in full uniform in a front row somewhere. So the whole time I was like worried that the surprise might get spoiled or something, but he definitely looked surprised in the photos.
Yes. Okay, well, thanks, Zane.
All right, thank you.
At the Franklin High School graduation, students mourned one of their own. Our reporter, Scott Causaleo from the Milford Daily News, covered that graduation. Hello, Scott.
Hey.
So what can you tell us more about what happened at this graduation?
Yeah, so back in April, senior James Walter Sewell III died in a car crash in Bellingham after hitting a pole. He was ejected from his vehicle. It wasn't because of drugs or alcohol. His friends said after the event that he seemed very tired. So it was a true tragedy. And at the graduation, his seat wasn't empty. They had a seat for him, but it was adorned with flowers and notes of commemoration for him. And Principal Paul Perry at Franklin High, during his speech, drew attention to the chair, and as they had a moment of silence for him, there were noticeably students around him that were tearing up, and they couldn't, you know, really look at the chair itself because they were really struck by the moment itself.
Yeah, it sounds like it was quite an emotional moment. And I remember this accident and the fact that he had been driving some friends, or had just dropped some of his friends off before he left and got into the accident. Is my memory correct?
Yeah, so he was out on a Saturday night, and he dropped some of his friends off. Like I said, no alcohol, no drugs involved. It was late at night, and he was driving his friends home. And like I mentioned, his friend said he was visibly very tired. So that seems to be the verdict, that he was just tired.
Yeah. Were his parents around for the graduation?
I did not see them or speak to them myself, but if they weren't there in person, I'm sure they were watching on TV.
Well, Scott, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
In Milford, Sierra Naturals, a marijuana cultivator and product manufacturer, is seeking to expand its local operation. Joining us now is Christopher Gavin from our Milford Daily News office. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ann.
So what's Sierra Naturals up to?
Well, that's a good question. So we know that they filed a plan to amend their current special permit with the Zoning Board of Appeals late last month. And it is only a two-page application that says that they are looking to build a 7,800-square-foot greenhouse on their existing property, which is up on Commercial Way, for those who might not know.
And this greenhouse would be an extension of a grow facility that they've been in, had in operation for about 3 years, right?
Yeah, that's what it seems. Unfortunately, I had made an effort this week to reach out to the president and CEO, Mike Dundas, but had not heard back from him nor his attorney yesterday. So I was hoping to get a little bit more information on what they hope to do. But what I do know is that at the site now, they do, as you said, cultivate. So they grow the marijuana. They pick it off the plants for medicinal use. And they also make edibles, oils, a bunch of different kinds of marijuana-based products there for medical use at dispensaries in Cambridge, Somerville, and Needham. They did tell the town back in March that they are planning on applying for 4 permits for adult use or recreational marijuana so that they can grow and do those things there. Basically, they said nothing. They didn't have any plans to change how they do anything. It's marijuana grows the same way, whether or not it's recreational or medical. So at the time, they said they didn't have any plans for the facility to change. They said maybe they were looking at a second facility in Milford down the line. But then this application came in on May 22nd, and that's basically all I know right now.
Has there been any reaction from town officials to this? Because Milford was a town that didn't want to have any dispensaries or, well, dispensaries. This was a grandfathered-in business. Do you think it's something they're going to have support for?
I wouldn't see it getting opposition. I mean, Sierra, like you said, they do have a history in town. They seem to be a good neighbor from people you talk to. I'm not really aware of any complaints that town officials have had about how they do business. You touched on something there a moment ago about how they were one of the two businesses, marijuana businesses in town that were grandfathered in these votes that we've seen in the last few months here in Milford, basically saying they don't want retail shops in town. They don't want other kinds of businesses coming in, but they are allowing Sierra to stay here. It was a compromise they reached with the business that they could expand into the recreational market. And in doing so, and this is not something that the town had asked for, but Sierra did put forth an agreement for a host community agreement that are going to be a few payments of $250,000 annually for the next 5 years that they're hoping the town can use to mitigate any kind of impact that they might have. But their current application that was just filed says that they haven't really had any problems in the last 3 years, and there doesn't seem to be any issues or safety concerns. So to answer your question, I don't think that there would be much opposition.
Well, another story that you've been covering is in Hopedale, where they're trying to create a historic district, and there's an upcoming public hearing on this, and I guess special town meeting. You've, in the last week, said there's some tweaking to the plan. So can you tell us first a little bit of the background of what this is and what voters are likely to see presented to them?
Sure. I'll try to do this in a nutshell if I can. Basically, the town's looking at creating a few local historic districts around Hopedale, which once they are created, would make Hopedale an official boundary of the Blackstone River Valley National Historical Park, a new national park that former President Barack Obama had signed into law and creating it a few years ago, I want to say in 2014 or 2015. So the study committee has been working on this for a while. It's coming up to a town meeting vote on June 19th, that special town meeting. But in the last month or so, it's gotten a little turbulent just because Part of one of those districts proposed by the committee was for the big former Draper Corporation factory that sits in the heart of Hopedale. It's been vacant for decades since it closed around 1980, and the owner had expressed, he objected to his property being included in this just out of fear that, putting some of these regulations on it could hurt his ability to sell or have it developed in the future, as well as some of the vacant land he owns. It wasn't just the factory, but a few parcels here and there that he had owned that he also didn't want to be a part of it, because it seems like if they preserve something and it's a vacant spot, in theory, a historic district commission in the future might have the potential to be able to regulate and say what goes on that site, and he was not a fan of that.
And so that there was a second property owner who came up just more recently, whose properties are also going to be not part of this. Is that correct?
Yes, partially. So what ended up happening is last week the study committee took a lot of that and put in, and they came back and said, all right, we've removed the mill, and they removed some of his other properties from different districts, and they kind of redid a few things. Now, this week, he had also made clear he didn't want two properties included in what it would be the Bancroft Park Local Historic District. So it's the same owner through a different LLC, Hopedale Properties, same guy, Phil Schwabman. But he does not want his properties included. So the selectmen this week had said, we're going to just try to take those two properties out of their two vacant lots. They just are going to want it removed through an addendum on town meeting floor.
And so the it sounds like the town officials are trying to get something together on this that could be approved by town meeting. And it looks like there's kind of like you just explained some of the tweaking and other things. So that vote is that comes before town meeting on June 19th, a special town meeting. Is there also a public hearing on this before that, information hearing?
Yes. Yeah, so by law, when they are creating these local historic districts, they do have to host public hearings. There was one last month, and I know that the committee has also done a few other things on their own meetings that, you know, basically an open door policy, but there will be an official public hearing next Wednesday at Town Hall. It's set for 7 p.m. And that is June 13th.
Okay, Wednesday. And the reason for doing this in the first place is there's some, what's the benefit to the town?
Well, it would put Hopedale on the map of this local, of this National Historical Park. But there is some idea that, properties included in districts might be eligible for certain grants for maintenance and stuff in the future. I know that officials have expressed interest in getting town-owned properties like the town hall, which they have lamented its current state. It is in need of repair, so the hope is maybe if it is included, and they can get access to some funding opportunities they might not have otherwise.
Well, Chris, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me, and always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Weekly News Roundup. You can find links to the stories, photos, and video we spoke about with this episode's show notes. Thank you to Caitlin Kelleher for producing and editing this episode. You can find the podcast in the Apple Store, on Google Play, and on our website, MetroWestDailyNews.com and MilfordDailyNews.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next week.